Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible, and specifically the story of Jesus, the story that the Gospels tell us is the greatest story ever told. Today, we're investigating the missing years of Jesus, and we do so on the request of our client, a 14-year-old young man who's interested in knowing what the exact truth of the Bible is. Here he is.
Hi, God's Gumshoe. It's me, Ichabod. I have another question. What do they mean when they refer to the silent years of Jesus? What were they, and what did he do? Thank you, Ichabod.
What's that, Ichabod? You didn't know that Jesus was missing? Whoa, good thing you've called God's Gumshoe. Watson and I'll get right on it. Seriously, though, the New Testament has a black hole that covers most of Jesus' life here on this planet. On one page of the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is 12 years old in the temple in Jerusalem. And then, nothing. Nothing for 18 years, until Jesus shows up at the River Jordan to be baptized by John the Baptist. This is due to the canonical Gospels having left a narrative vacuum, and many have attempted to fill that vacuum. Now, while his birth and later ministerial years are well documented in the Gospels of the New Testament, and of course his death, a question mark continues to hang over how Jesus spent his time between the ages of roughly 4, when they returned from Egypt, to about 12, and the years between, say, 13 and 30. This baffling gap spans the period that stretches from his preaching in the temple as a young boy, right up to the point where, as a grown man, and according to the Bible, he first met John the Baptist. Today, and on the program next week, we will explore this 18 to 20 year gap that, incredibly, nobody knows very much about. The debate continues to rage over where the young Christ was during these missing years. Some wild theories have claimed that he traveled far and wide to India, to Tibet, to England, other destinations. Others claim that it is far more likely that he remained in Nazareth, leading a humble life as a working carpenter. Now, scholars and theologians are using clues from ancient texts to piece together the events of Jesus' young adulthood in an attempt to shed new light on the unknown parts of his life. So once again, we will begin with the biblical worldview and in their voice tell us what it is that they hold to be the truth about this matter. We'll then take a look at the scholastic investigation into this particular issue and particular situation. And then once again, we'll listen to the third voice in our parade of witnesses called the Urantia Papers. You be the judge, because this really is a great mystery.
So Jesus was a baby, and now he's a man. Wasn't he ever a boy?
Sure he was. My grandmother told me that when Jesus was about 12 years old, Mary and Joseph took him here to Jerusalem. Jesus went to the temple and talked with all the leaders and teachers.
When Jesus was 12 years old, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem for the Passover feast. But when they started back home, thinking that the boy was with them, Jesus stayed behind. They returned to the city looking for him, and on the third day found him in the temple sitting with the rabbis and elders.
Whose child is this who asks such questions?
He's from Nazareth. We thought he had left with us. Please forgive him his zeal.
All who heard him were amazed.
Son, why have you done this to us? The father and I have been terribly worried trying to find you. Or is it that you looked for me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?
And he came with them to Nazareth and increased in wisdom and stature, and in favor with God and with man.
Chapter 13. The Boy Jesus Visits Jerusalem. Every year Joseph and Mary went to Jerusalem to celebrate the feast of the Passover. And when Jesus was 12 years old, he went up to Jerusalem with his parents to celebrate the custom of the feast. And when the celebration was complete, Mary and Joseph began the trip home thinking that Jesus was in the crowd that was returning to Nazareth after the celebration. But Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. One day passed, and Jesus' parents realized, after searching all over for Jesus, that he was not among them. They immediately returned to Jerusalem, and after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers. Jesus was listening and asking questions, and everyone that heard Jesus was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When Mary and Joseph saw Jesus, they were astonished. Mary said to Jesus, "Why have you treated us this way? Your father and I have been worried sick, looking for you everywhere." Jesus said to them, "How is it that you were looking for me? Didn't you know that I must be in my father's house?" Mary and Joseph did not understand what Jesus was saying to them, and they left together to return to Nazareth. And Jesus was subject to his parents, and Mary kept all these sayings in her heart. Jesus advanced in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Not much else is known about the life of Jesus until John the Baptist begins his public ministry and Jesus bursts on the scene, followed by signs, wonders, and miracles.
One way or the other, the point of the infancy stories is to ensure that from the very first moment, this redeeming figure has been underwritten by God.
After Jesus' birth, the Gospels are almost completely silent about what happened next. We're told that his family returned to Nazareth, but there is only one story about his childhood in Galilee. It has led to a lot of wild speculation as to what Jesus was doing during those years, how he might have traveled all over the Middle East and Egypt and even as far as India and Tibet to study with Eastern mystics. There is one area of biblical research that can take our knowledge of the past beyond the written sources and help to explain Jesus' lost years and the world in which he grew up.
I think there's a gap in terms of the narration about Jesus' life, really because it didn't serve the interests of the gospel writers. They're trying to write something else, so they don't mind putting in miraculous birth, at least two of them. And Luke doesn't mind putting in this story about Jesus being around 12 to show he's precocious. John starts off with creation. So then they're trying to get us to the ministry, apparently. So they just simply jump ahead to the ministry. So we are left to surmise that he grew up more or less like everyone else in Galilee. Now what archaeology does for us is show us what that might look like.
Professor James Strange is one of the world's leading biblical archaeologists. For the last 30 years, he has been excavating one of Galilee's most important first century cities, Sepphoris. Professor Strange believes that because Jesus' home village of Nazareth was just 2 hours' walk away, he could very possibly have visited and worked here.
Well, here we are on the main road of Sepphoris. And people would be streaming in from behind me towards Tiberias. They would be coming from Nazareth, from ancient Garris, from other places. They're coming here to buy, to sell, to look for a physician, whatever it is they need. They come in sometimes because they're curious, but sometimes they're looking for work. So this is going to be an ideal place to do exactly that.
Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? Hidden away in the Gospels, in a description of Jesus as he begins his ministry in Galilee, is a single verse that provides a few clues as to Jesus' early life. Traditionally, Jesus has been described as a carpenter. But a more accurate translation of the original Greek word tekton would be a general builder.
Jesus and his father, and presumably his brothers then, as a tekton, means a family that is understood to be working with their hands, and they have all the skills and knowledge they have to work with wood and to work with stone. So this is fundamental to the living here. That makes Jesus and his family ideal for such a place as this when it's undergoing construction for the first time.
During Jesus' childhood, Sepphoris was undergoing a major building boom under the local king, Herod Antipas. For Jesus and his brothers, this would have been an ideal place to have looked for work.
Well, 5-6 kilometers away is ancient Nazareth itself, where Jesus lives with his father and his brothers and his sisters, his mother. So it's not at all out of reason that he would be here with his father as the eldest, looking for work. So I think of this as an ideal place to contextualize Jesus as a jobbing builder who builds projects for anything from houses or as small as an ox yoke all the way up to working on frameworks and doing stone cutting for large buildings. We can see the first century cut stones reflected everywhere we look.
Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? The gospel accounts appear to suggest that Jesus had an extended blood family. In fact, in the first century Jewish world in which he lived, not having any brothers or sisters would have been very unusual. But over the centuries, the idea of Jesus having a close family has posed a problem for some Christian denominations.
We understand from Scripture that Jesus came from an extended family. It was not simply Joseph, Mary, and Jesus living in the household, but there were siblings, at least 4 more brothers, whose names we know, and at least 2 more sisters, and maybe more. Unfortunately, we don't know their names.
According to Roman Catholics and Orthodox Christians, Jesus' mother, Mary, was a perpetual virgin, and that after giving birth to him, she had no further children. So they believe his brothers and sisters are not blood relations of Jesus.
The traditional explanation for the brothers of Jesus, for example, in the Greek Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, has been that Joseph was a widower, and he had children from his first marriage who became the stepbrothers of Jesus, and that would put Jesus as the only child of Mary. In the Protestant tradition, they see these children as being the biological children of Joseph and Mary, born after Jesus. So in whatever way you would want to explain it, though, we understand that Jesus doesn't grow up as an only child.
When Jesus was growing up, Nazareth was just a small village of less than 500 people. But today, it is a huge city in modern Israel. No remains of the ancient village had ever been found until 2 years ago, when an extraordinary find was uncovered near the center of the city.
Well, around 2009, some builders were trying to build something here. And when they drove the foundation down, they discovered something they thought would be of interest to archaeologists. So that's exactly what they did. They called in the archaeologists so that they could check this. When they went down far enough, they found they were in a first century house. This is a very exciting find. We have people who are still so skeptical that they claim there's no Nazareth in the first century. So it's wonderful confirmation that we were not mistaken. There really is a first century Nazareth.
According to the archaeologists, it was a very simple building, single story, made of mud and stone with 2 rooms and a courtyard. They also found clay and chalk vessels that were known to be used by Galilean Jews at that time, an indication that the house was lived in by a devout Jewish family.
By looking at the Gospel of Luke, for example, we can see that Jesus was born into a Jewish family that was religiously observant. They were pious people. They prayed. They went on pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and it was their custom. They circumcised him on the eighth day. They announced his name. They paid the redemption price of a newborn son. And so the picture we get of Jesus' family is a family that is deeply embedded in its Jewish identity and its Jewish tradition.
Well, religion in the first century is not a separate category. It suffuses your life. You know, the modern idea of religion as being some aspect of your life is very, very modern, or postmodern for some. So in the first century, it's just sort of a given. You know there's God in the universe, and God has made all that there is.
And Jesus brought a message that he learned in his own childhood. His classroom was the streets of a Jewish town, and he watched shepherds with their sheep and goats. He watched farmers in the field as they spread grain. He watched fathers with their children. And he thought about these things that he observed. They became the images that he would later use in his parables, so that when he launched his public ministry and he spoke to everyday people on the street, tax collectors, sinners, women, he could speak to them about God in language that they understood.
Well, the lost years of Jesus, from 12 to 30, I think he's a full-fledged member of his family and of his village. We would expect him to then, as a firstborn son, to be married, but he's not. We would also expect him to, if something has happened to Joseph, for example, since Joseph disappears in the narrative, if he was killed or in an accident or just died of an infection, then it falls upon Jesus to stay home, take care of his mother. He didn't do that. We would not expect him to have detailed knowledge of Jewish traditions, temple traditions, and scriptures themselves. But he apparently does. And so we're confounded in each time we make this prediction about Jesus. We're very good about predicting what we would find if we dig in an environment like Sepphoris. We're much less successful in predicting what Jesus would turn out to be.
Now, let us join our third voice in this discussion. And we do so at a time when Jesus is about 3 years old, and he's in Egypt, in Alexandria, preparing to leave for their home in Nazareth. Here, my friend Watson has been doing his research, and he will give us a synoptic view of Jesus from about 4 to about 6 years old.
My selections on the silent years of Jesus are from the Urantia book, An Epical Revelation in the Public Domain. Thus, the material may be shared if you so desire. Paper 123, The Early Childhood of Jesus. Throughout the 2 years of their sojourn at Alexandria, Egypt, Jesus enjoyed good health and continued to grow normally. Joseph and Mary finally took leave of Alexandria, bound for Joppa, arriving at the port late in August of the year 4 BC. They went directly to Bethlehem, where they spent the entire month of September in council with their friends and relatives concerning whether they should remain there or go to Nazareth. Section 1. Back in Nazareth. Jesus was about 3 years and 2 months old at the time of their return to Nazareth. He had stood all these travels very well and was in excellent health and full of childish glee and excitement at having premises of his own to run about in to enjoy. But he greatly missed the association of his Alexandrian playmates. Jesus' entire fourth year was a period of normal physical development and of unusual mental activity. The next important event in the life of this Nazareth family was the birth of the second child, James, in the early morning hours of April 2, 3 BC. Jesus was thrilled by the thought of having a baby brother. He would stand around by the hour just to observe the baby's early activities. Jesus, as he grew up, when not at school, spent his time about equally between helping his mother with home duties and watching his father work at the shop. Meanwhile, listening to the conversation and gossip of the caravan conductors and passengers from the four corners of the earth. Section 2, the fifth year, 2 BC. In something more than a year after the return to Nazareth, the boy Jesus arrived at the age of his first personal and wholehearted moral decision. And there came to abide with him a thought adjuster, a divine gift of the Paradise Father, which had aforetime served with Machiaventa Melchizedek. That is a son of God sent down here to earth about 2,000 years earlier. Thus gaining the experience of functioning in connection with the incarnation of a supermortal being living in the likeness of mortal flesh. This event occurred on February 11th, 2 BC. Jesus was no more aware of the coming of the divine monitor than are the millions upon millions of other children who, before and since that day, have likewise received these thought adjusters to indwell their minds and work for the ultimate spiritualization of these minds and the eternal survival of their evolving immortal souls. On this day in February, the direct and personal supervision of the universe rulers, as it was related to the integrity of the childlike incarnation of Christ Michael, terminated. From that time on, throughout the human unfolding of the incarnation, the guardianship of Jesus was destined to rest in the keeping of this indwelling adjuster and the associated seraphic guardians. Jesus was 5 years old in August of this year, and we will, therefore, refer to this as his fifth calendar year of life. In this year, 2 BC, a little more than 1 month before his fifth birthday anniversary, Jesus was made very happy by the coming of his sister Miriam, who was born on the night of July 11th. During the evening of the following day, Jesus had a long talk with his father concerning the manner in which various groups of living things are born into the world as separate individuals. The most valuable part of Jesus' early education was secured from his parents in answer to his thoughtful and searching inquiries. Joseph never failed to do his full duty in taking pains and spending time answering the boy's numerous questions. From the time Jesus was 5 years old until he was 10, he was one continuous question mark. While Joseph and Mary could not always answer his questions, they never failed fully to discuss his inquiries and in every other possible way to assist him in his efforts to reach a satisfactory solution of the problems which his alert mind had suggested. Jesus greatly enjoyed his little brother and his baby sister and was of great help to Mary in their care. Mary provided on the roof of the house, the summer bedroom, shallow boxes of sand in which Jesus worked out maps and did much of his early practice at writing Aramaic, Greek, and later on Hebrew. For in time he learned to read, write, and speak fluently all three languages. Jesus appeared to be a well-nigh perfect child physically and continued to make normal progress mentally and emotionally. Jesus was exceedingly inquisitive about many significant things and events. Section 3, Events of the Sixth Year. That's 1 B.C. Already, with his mother's help, Jesus had mastered the Galilean dialect of the Aramaic tongue, and now his father began teaching him Greek. Mary spoke little Greek, but Joseph was a fluent speaker of both Aramaic and Greek. The textbook for the study of the Greek language was a copy of the Hebrew Scriptures, a complete version of the Law and the Prophets, including the Psalms, which had been presented to them on leaving Egypt. There were only two complete copies of the scriptures in Greek in all Nazareth, and the possession of one of them by the carpenter's family made Joseph's home a much sought place and enabled Jesus, as he grew up, to meet an almost endless procession of earnest students and sincere truth seekers. Before this year ended, Jesus had assumed custody of this priceless manuscript, having been told on his sixth birthday that the sacred book had been presented to him by Alexandrian friends and relatives. And in a very short time, he could read it readily. Even at an early age, it was very difficult to answer Jesus' questions about physical or social phenomena by thoughtlessly telling him that either God or the devil was responsible. In harmony with the prevailing belief of the Jewish people, Jesus was long willing to accept the doctrine of good spirits and evil spirits as the possible explanation of mental and spiritual phenomena. But he very early became doubtful that such unseen influences were responsible for the physical happenings of the natural world. Before Jesus was 6 years of age, in the early summer of 1 BC, Zacharias and Elizabeth and their son John, later known as John the Baptist, came to visit the Nazareth family. Jesus and John had a happy time during this, their first visit, within their memories. Having met John, who came from near Jerusalem, Jesus began to evince an unusual interest in the history of Israel and to inquire in great detail as to the meaning of the Sabbath rites on Saturday for Jews. The synagogue also, he was inquisitive about the synagogue sermons and the recurring feast of commemoration. While some of these celebrations and observances were rightfully difficult for Jesus' young mind to understand, he pondered them seriously. Even at this early age, young Jesus had a keen sense of what is true and spiritual and godly and what is merely human-made errors. During this year, Joseph and Mary had trouble with Jesus about his prayers. He insisted on talking to his heavenly Father much as he would talk to Joseph, his earthly father. And I add that true personal religion everywhere and at all time. That's what Jesus practiced and teaches us to do. This departure from the more solemn and reverent modes of communication with deity was a bit disconcerting to his parents, especially to his mother. But there was no persuading him to change. He would say his prayers just as he had been taught, after which he insisted on having, quote, just a little talk with my Father in heaven, unquote. The next few years, Joseph, as a builder, did considerable work at Cana, Bethlehem of Galilee, Magdala, Nain, Sepphoris, Capernaum, and Endor, as well as much building in and near Nazareth. As James grew up to be old enough to help his mother with the housework and care of the younger children, Jesus made frequent trips away from home with his father to these surrounding towns and villages. Jesus was a keen observer and gained much practical knowledge from these trips away from home. He was assiduously storing up knowledge regarding man and the way he lived on earth. Much of his spare time, when his mother did not require his help about the house, was spent studying the flowers and plants by day and the stars by night. He showed a troublesome liking for lying on his back and gazing wonderingly up into the starry heavens long after his usual bedtime in this well-ordered Nazareth household.
Thank you, Watson. Now let's join a young Jesus at about age 12, 13 years old as he prepares for his journey to Jerusalem. For this, we'll listen to the voice of the Urantia Papers.
5. His 13th year, AD 7. In this year, the lad of Nazareth passed from boyhood to the beginning of young manhood. His voice began to change, and other features of mind and body gave evidence of the oncoming status of manhood. On Sunday night, January 9, AD 7, his baby brother Amos was born. Jude was not yet 2 years of age, and the baby sister Ruth was yet to come. So it may be seen that Jesus had a sizable family of small children left to his watch care when his father met his accidental death the following year. It was about the middle of February that Jesus became humanly assured that he was destined to perform a mission on earth for the enlightenment of man and the revelation of God. Momentous decisions, coupled with far-reaching plans, were formulating in the mind of this youth, who was, to outward appearances, an average Jewish lad of Nazareth. The intelligent life of all Nebadon looked on with fascination and amazement as all this began to unfold in the thinking and acting of the now adolescent carpenter's son. On the first day of the week, March 20, A.D. 7, Jesus graduated from the course of training in the local school connected with the Nazareth synagogue. This was a great day in the life of any ambitious Jewish family, the day when the firstborn son was pronounced a son of the commandment, and the ransomed firstborn of the Lord God of Israel, a child of the Most High, and a servant of the Lord of all the earth. Friday of the week before, Joseph had come over from Sepphoris, where he was in charge of the work on a new public building, to be present on this glad occasion. Jesus' teacher confidently believed that this alert and diligent pupil was destined to some outstanding career, some distinguished mission. The elders, notwithstanding all their trouble with Jesus' nonconformist tendencies, were very proud of the lad, and had already begun laying plans which would enable him to go to Jerusalem to continue his education in the renowned Hebrew academies. As Jesus heard these plans discussed from time to time, he became increasingly sure that he would never go to Jerusalem to study with the rabbis. But he little dreamed of the tragedy so soon to occur, which would ensure the abandonment of all such plans by causing him to assume the responsibility for the support and direction of a large family, presently to consist of 5 brothers and 3 sisters, as well as his mother and himself. Jesus had a larger and longer experience rearing this family than was accorded to Joseph, his father, and he did measure up to the standard which he subsequently set for himself, to become a wise, patient, understanding, and effective teacher and eldest brother to this family, his family, so suddenly sorrow-stricken and so unexpectedly bereaved. 6. The Journey to Jerusalem. Jesus, having now reached the threshold of young manhood, and having been formally graduated from the synagogue schools, was qualified to proceed to Jerusalem with his parents to participate with them in the celebration of his first Passover. The Passover feast of this year fell on Saturday, April 9, A.D. 7. A considerable company, 103, made ready to depart from Nazareth early Monday morning, April 4, for Jerusalem. They journeyed south toward Samaria, but on reaching Jezreel, they turned east, going around Mount Gilboa into the Jordan Valley in order to avoid passing through Samaria. Joseph and his family would have enjoyed going down through Samaria by way of Jacob's Well and Bethel, but since the Jews disliked to deal with the Samaritans, they decided to go with their neighbors by way of the Jordan Valley. The much-dreaded Archelaus had been deposed, and they had little to fear in taking Jesus to Jerusalem. 12 years had passed since the first Herod had sought to destroy the babe of Bethlehem, and no one would now think of associating that affair with this obscure lad of Nazareth. Before reaching the Jezreel junction, and as they journeyed on, very soon on the left they passed the ancient village of Shunem, and Jesus heard again about the most beautiful maiden of all Israel who once lived there, and also about the wonderful works Elisha performed there. In passing by Jezreel, Jesus' parents recounted the doings of Ahab and Jezebel, and the exploits of Jehu. In passing around Mount Gilboa, they talked much about Saul, who took his life on the slopes of this mountain, King David, and the associations of this historic spot. As they rounded the base of Gilboa, the pilgrims could see the Greek city of Scythopolis on the right. They gazed upon the marble structures from a distance, but went not near the Gentile city, lest they so defile themselves that they could not participate in the forthcoming solemn and sacred ceremonies of the Passover at Jerusalem. Mary could not understand why neither Joseph nor Jesus would speak of Scythopolis. She did not know about their controversy of the previous year, as they had never revealed this episode to her. The road now led immediately down into the tropical Jordan Valley, and soon Jesus was to have exposed to his wondering gaze the crooked and ever-winding Jordan with its glistening and rippling waters as it flowed down toward the Dead Sea. They laid aside their outer garments as they journeyed south in this tropical valley, enjoying the luxurious fields of grain and the beautiful oleanders laden with their pink blossoms, while massive snow-capped Mount Hermon stood far to the north, in majesty looking down on the historic valley. A little over 3 hours' travel from opposite Scythopolis, they came upon a bubbling spring, and here they camped for the night, out under the starlit heavens. On their second day's journey, they passed by where the Jabbok, from the east, flows into the Jordan, and looking east up this river valley, they recounted the days of Gideon, when the Midianites poured into this region to overrun the land. Toward the end of the second day's journey, they camped near the base of the highest mountain overlooking the Jordan Valley, Mount Sartaba, whose summit was occupied by the Alexandrian fortress where Herod had imprisoned one of his wives and buried his 2 strangled sons. The third day they passed by 2 villages which had been recently built by Herod, and noted their superior architecture and their beautiful palm gardens. By nightfall they reached Jericho, where they remained until the morrow. That evening Joseph, Mary, and Jesus walked 1.5 miles to the site of the ancient Jericho, where Joshua, for whom Jesus was named, had performed his renowned exploits according to Jewish tradition. By the fourth and last day's journey, the road was a continuous procession of pilgrims. They now began to climb the hills leading up to Jerusalem. As they neared the top, they could look across the Jordan to the mountains beyond, and south over the sluggish waters of the Dead Sea. About halfway up to Jerusalem, Jesus gained his first view of the Mount of Olives, the region to be so much a part of his subsequent life. And Joseph pointed out to him that the holy city lay just beyond this ridge. And the lad's heart beat fast with joyous anticipation of soon beholding the city and house of his heavenly Father. On the eastern slopes of Olivet, they paused for rest in the borders of a little village called Bethany. The hospitable villagers poured forth to minister to the pilgrims, and it happened that Joseph and his family had stopped near the house of one Simon, who had three children about the same age as Jesus, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. They invited the Nazareth family in for refreshment, and a lifelong friendship sprang up between the two families. Many times afterward in his eventful life, Jesus stopped in this home. They pressed on, soon standing on the brink of Olivet, and Jesus saw for the first time, in his memory, the holy city, the pretentious palaces, and the inspiring temple of his Father. At no time in his life did Jesus ever experience such a purely human thrill as that which at this time so completely enthralled him as he stood there on this April afternoon on the Mount of Olives, drinking in his first view of Jerusalem. And in after years, on this same spot, he stood and wept over the city which was about to reject another prophet, the last and the greatest of her heavenly teachers. But they hurried on to Jerusalem. It was now Thursday afternoon. On reaching the city, they journeyed past the temple, and never had Jesus beheld such throngs of human beings. He meditated deeply on how these Jews had assembled here from the uttermost parts of the known world. Soon they reached the place prearranged for their accommodation during the Passover week, the large home of a well-to-do relative of Mary's, one who knew something of the early history of both John and Jesus through Zacharias. The following day, the day of preparation, they made ready for the appropriate celebration of the Passover Sabbath. While all Jerusalem was astir in preparation for the Passover, Joseph found time to take his son around to visit the academy where it had been arranged for him to resume his education 2 years later, as soon as he reached the required age of 15. Joseph was truly puzzled when he observed how little interest Jesus evinced in all these carefully laid plans. Jesus was profoundly impressed by the temple and all the associated services and other activities. For the first time since he was 4 years old, he was too much preoccupied with his own meditations to ask many questions. He did, however, ask his father several embarrassing questions, as he had on previous occasions, as to why the Heavenly Father required the slaughter of so many innocent and helpless animals. And his father well knew from the expression on the lad's face that his answers and attempts at explanation were unsatisfactory to his deep-thinking and keen-reasoning son. On the day before the Passover Sabbath, flood tides of spiritual illumination swept through the mortal mind of Jesus and filled his human heart to overflowing with affectionate pity for the spiritually blind and morally ignorant multitudes assembled for the celebration of the ancient Passover commemoration. This was one of the most extraordinary days that the Son of God spent in the flesh, and during the night, for the first time in his earth career, there appeared to him an assigned messenger from Salvington, commissioned by Emmanuel, who said, "The hour has come. It is time that you begin to be about your Father's business." And so, even ere the heavy responsibilities of the Nazareth family descended upon his youthful shoulders, there now arrived the celestial messenger to remind this lad, not quite 13 years of age, that the hour had come to begin the resumption of the responsibilities of a universe. This was the first act of a long succession of events which finally culminated in the completion of the Son's bestowal on Urantia and the replacing of the government of a universe on his human, divine shoulders. As time passed, the mystery of the Incarnation became, to all of us, more and more unfathomable. We could hardly comprehend that this lad of Nazareth was the creator of all Nebadon. Neither do we nowadays understand how the spirit of this same Creator Son and the spirit of his Paradise Father are associated with the souls of mankind. With the passing of time, we could see that his human mind was increasingly discerning that, while he lived his life in the flesh, in spirit, on his shoulders rested the responsibility of a universe. Thus ends the career of the Nazareth lad. and begins the narrative of that adolescent youth, the increasingly self-conscious divine human, who now begins the contemplation of his world career as he strives to integrate his expanding life purpose with the desires of his parents and his obligations to his family and the society of his day and age. Paper 125, Jesus at Jerusalem. No incident in all Jesus' eventful earth career was more engaging, more humanly thrilling, than this, his first remembered visit to Jerusalem. He was especially stimulated by the experience of attending the temple discussions by himself, and it long stood out in his memory as the great event of his later childhood and early youth. This was his first opportunity to enjoy a few days of independent living, the exhilaration of going and coming without restraint and restrictions. This brief period of undirected living, during the week following the Passover, was the first complete freedom from responsibility he had ever enjoyed, and it was many years subsequent to this before he again had a like period of freedom from all sense of responsibility, even for a short time. Women seldom went to the Passover feast at Jerusalem. They were not required to be present. Jesus, however, virtually refused to go unless his mother would accompany them. And when his mother decided to go, many other Nazareth women were led to make the journey, so that the Passover company contained the largest number of women in proportion to men ever to go up to the Passover from Nazareth. Ever and anon on the way to Jerusalem, they chanted the 130th Psalm. From the time they left Nazareth until they reached the summit of the Mount of Olives, Jesus experienced one long stress of expectant anticipation. All through a joyful childhood he had reverently heard of Jerusalem and its temple. Now he was soon to behold them in reality. From the Mount of Olives and from the outside on closer inspection, the temple had been all and more than Jesus had expected. But when he once entered its sacred portals, the great disillusionment began. In company with his parents, Jesus passed through the temple precincts on his way to join that group of new sons of the law who were about to be consecrated as citizens of Israel. He was a little disappointed by the general demeanor of the temple throngs, but the first great shock of the day came when his mother took leave of them on her way to the women's gallery. It had never occurred to Jesus that his mother was not to accompany him to the consecration ceremonies, and he was thoroughly indignant that she was made to suffer from such unjust discrimination. While he strongly resented this, aside from a few remarks of protest to his father, he said nothing. But he thought, and thought deeply, as his questions to the scribes and teachers a week later disclosed. He passed through the consecration rituals, but was disappointed by their perfunctory and routine natures. He missed that personal interest which characterized the ceremonies of the synagogue at Nazareth. He then returned to greet his mother and prepared to accompany his father on his first trip about the temple and its various courts, galleries, and corridors. The temple precincts could accommodate over 200,000 worshippers at one time, and while the vastness of these buildings, in comparison with any he had ever seen, greatly impressed his mind, he was more intrigued by the contemplation of the spiritual significance of the temple ceremonies and their associated worship. Though many of the temple rituals very touchingly impressed his sense of the beautiful and the symbolic, he was always disappointed by the explanation of the real meanings of these ceremonies, which his parents would offer in answer to his many searching inquiries. Jesus simply would not accept explanations of worship and religious devotion which involved belief in the wrath of God or the anger of the Almighty. In further discussion of these questions, after the conclusion of the temple visit, when his father became mildly insistent that he acknowledge acceptance of the Orthodox Jewish beliefs, Jesus turned suddenly upon his parents, and looking appealingly into the eyes of his father, said, "My father, it cannot be true. The Father in heaven cannot so regard his erring children on earth. The heavenly Father cannot love his children less than you love me, and I well know, no matter what unwise thing I might do, you would never pour out wrath upon me, nor vent anger against me. If you, my earthly father, possess such human reflections of the divine, how much more must the heavenly Father be filled with goodness and overflowing with mercy? I refuse to believe that my Father in heaven loves me less than my Father on earth." When Joseph and Mary heard these words of their firstborn son, they held their peace. And never again did they seek to change his mind about the love of God and the mercifulness of the Father in heaven. 1. Jesus views the temple. Everywhere Jesus went throughout the temple courts, he was shocked and sickened by the spirit of irreverence which he observed. He deemed the conduct of the temple throngs to be inconsistent with their presence in his Father's house. But he received the shock of his young life when his father escorted him to the court of the Gentiles with its noisy jargon, loud talking, and cursing, mingled indiscriminately with the bleating of sheep and the babble of noises which betrayed the presence of the money changers and the vendors of sacrificial animals and sundry other commercial commodities. But most of all was his sense of propriety outraged by the sight of the frivolous courtesans parading about within this precinct of the temple, just such painted women as he had so recently seen when on a visit to Sepphoris. This profanation of the temple fully aroused all his youthful indignation, and he did not hesitate to express himself freely to Joseph. Jesus admired the sentiment and service of the temple, but he was shocked by the spiritual ugliness which he beheld on the faces of so many of the unthinking worshippers. They now passed down to the priest's court beneath the rock ledge in front of the temple, where the altar stood, to observe the killing of the droves of animals and the washing away of the blood from the hands of the officiating slaughter priests at the bronze fountain. The blood-stained pavement, the gory hands of the priests, and the sounds of the dying animals were more than this nature-loving lad could stand. The terrible sight sickened this boy of Nazareth. He clutched his father's arm and begged to be taken away. They walked back through the court of the Gentiles, and even the coarse laughter and profane jesting which he there heard were a relief from the sights he had just beheld. Joseph saw how his son had sickened at the sight of the temple rites, and wisely led him around to view the Gate Beautiful, the artistic gate made of Corinthian bronze. But Jesus had had enough for his first visit at the temple. They returned to the upper court for Mary and walked about in the open air and away from the crowds for an hour, viewing the Asmonean palace, the stately home of Herod, and the tower of the Roman guards. During this stroll, Joseph explained to Jesus that only the inhabitants of Jerusalem were permitted to witness the daily sacrifices in the temple, and that the dwellers in Galilee came up only 3 times a year to participate in the temple worship, at the Passover, at the Feast of Pentecost, 7 weeks after Passover, and at the Feast of Tabernacles in October. These feasts were established by Moses. They then discussed the 2 later established feasts of the Dedication and of Purim. Afterward, they went to their lodgings and made ready for the celebration of the Passover. Two, Jesus and the Passover. 5 Nazareth families were guests of, or associates with, the family of Simon of Bethany in the celebration of the Passover, Simon having purchased the paschal lamb for the company. It was the slaughter of these lambs in such enormous numbers that had so affected Jesus on his temple visit. It had been the plan to eat the Passover with Mary's relatives, but Jesus persuaded his parents to accept the invitation to go to Bethany. That night they assembled for the Passover rites, eating the roasted flesh with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Jesus, being a new son of the covenant, was asked to recount the origin of the Passover, and this he well did, but he somewhat disconcerted his parents by the inclusion of numerous remarks mildly reflecting the impressions made on his youthful but thoughtful mind by the things which he had so recently seen and heard. This was the beginning of the 7-day ceremonies of the Feast of the Passover. Even at this early date, though he said nothing about such matters to his parents, Jesus had begun to turn over in his mind the propriety of celebrating the Passover without the slaughtered lamb. He felt assured in his own mind that the Father in heaven was not pleased with this spectacle of sacrificial offerings, and as the years passed, he became increasingly determined someday to establish the celebration of a bloodless Passover. Jesus slept very little that night. His rest was greatly disturbed by revolting dreams of slaughter and suffering. His mind was distraught and his heart torn by the inconsistencies and absurdities of the theology of the whole Jewish ceremonial system. His parents likewise slept little. They were greatly disconcerted by the events of the day just ended. They were completely upset in their own hearts by the lad's, to them, strange and determined attitude. Mary became nervously agitated during the forepart of the night, but Joseph remained calm, though he was equally puzzled. Both of them feared to talk frankly with the lad about these problems, though Jesus would gladly have talked with his parents if they had dared to encourage him. The next day's services at the temple were more acceptable to Jesus and did much to relieve the unpleasant memories of the previous day. The following morning, young Lazarus took Jesus in hand, and they began a systematic exploration of Jerusalem and its environs. Before the day was over, Jesus discovered the various places about the temple where teaching and question conferences were in progress. And aside from a few visits to the Holy of Holies to gaze and wonder as to what really was behind the veil of separation, he spent most of his time about the temple at these teaching conferences. Throughout the Passover week, Jesus kept his place among the new sons of the commandment, and this meant that he must seat himself outside the rail which segregated all persons who were not full citizens of Israel. Being thus made conscious of his youth, he refrained from asking the many questions which surged back and forth in his mind. At least he refrained until the Passover celebration had ended, and these restrictions on the newly consecrated youths were lifted. On Wednesday of the Passover week, Jesus was permitted to go home with Lazarus to spend the night at Bethany. This evening, Lazarus, Martha, and Mary heard Jesus discuss things temporal and eternal, human and divine, and from that night on, all three loved him as if he had been their own brother. By the end of the week, Jesus saw less of Lazarus, since he was not eligible for admission to even the outer circle of the temple discussions, though he attended some of the public talks delivered in the outer courts. Lazarus was the same age as Jesus, but in Jerusalem youths were seldom admitted to the consecration of sons of the law until they were a full 13 years of age. Again and again during the Passover week, his parents would find Jesus sitting off by himself with his youthful head in his hands, profoundly thinking. They had never seen him behave like this, and not knowing how much he was confused in mind and troubled in spirit by the experience through which he was passing, they were sorely perplexed. They did not know what to do. They welcomed the passing of the days of the Passover week and longed to have their strangely acting son safely back in Nazareth. Day by day, Jesus was thinking through his problems. By the end of the week, he had made many adjustments, but when the time came to return to Nazareth, his youthful mind was still swarming with perplexities and beset by a host of unanswered questions and unsolved problems. Before Joseph and Mary left Jerusalem, in company with Jesus' Nazareth teacher, they made definite arrangements for Jesus to return when he reached the age of 15 to begin his long course of study in one of the best-known academies of the rabbis. Jesus accompanied his parents and teacher on their visits to the school, but they were all distressed to observe how indifferent he seemed to all they said and did. Mary was deeply pained at his reactions to the Jerusalem visit, and Joseph was profoundly perplexed at the lad's strange remarks and unusual conduct. After all, Passover week had been a great event in Jesus' life. He had enjoyed the opportunity of meeting scores of boys about his own age, fellow candidates for the consecration, and he utilized such contacts as a means of learning how people lived in Mesopotamia, Turkestan, and Parthia, as well as in the far western provinces of Rome. He was already fairly conversant with the way in which the youth of Egypt and other regions near Palestine grew up. There were thousands of young people in Jerusalem at this time, and the Nazareth lad personally met and more or less extensively interviewed more than 150. He was particularly interested in those who hailed from the far eastern and the remote western countries. As a result of these contacts, the lad began to entertain a desire to travel about the world for the purpose of learning how the various groups of his fellow men toiled for their livelihood. 3. Departure of Joseph and Mary. It had been arranged that the Nazareth party should gather in the region of the temple at mid-forenoon on the first day of the week after the Passover festival had ended. This they did and started out on the return journey to Nazareth. Jesus had gone into the temple to listen to the discussions while his parents awaited the assembly of their fellow travelers. Presently, the company prepared to depart, the men going in one group and the women in another, as was their custom in journeying to and from the Jerusalem festivals. Jesus had gone up to Jerusalem in company with his mother and the women. Being now a young man of the consecration, he was supposed to journey back to Nazareth in company with his father and the men. But as the Nazareth party moved on toward Bethany, Jesus was completely absorbed in the discussion of angels in the temple, being wholly unmindful of the passing of the time for the departure of his parents. And he did not realize that he had been left behind until the noontime adjournment of the temple conferences. The Nazareth travelers did not miss Jesus because Mary surmised he journeyed with the men, while Joseph thought he traveled with the women since he had gone up to Jerusalem with the women, leading Mary's donkey. They did not discover his absence until they reached Jericho and prepared to tarry for the night. After making inquiry of the last of the party to reach Jericho and learning that none of them had seen their son, they spent a sleepless night turning over in their minds what might have happened to him, recounting many of his unusual reactions to the events of the Passover week, and mildly chiding each other for not seeing to it that he was in the group before they left Jerusalem. 4. First and Second Days in the Temple. In the meantime, Jesus had remained in the temple throughout the afternoon, listening to the discussions and enjoying the more quiet and decorous atmosphere, the great crowds of Passover week having about disappeared. At the conclusion of the afternoon discussions, in none of which Jesus participated, he betook himself to Bethany, arriving just as Simon's family made ready to partake of their evening meal. The three youngsters were overjoyed to greet Jesus, and he remained in Simon's house for the night. He visited very little during the evening, spending much of the time alone in the garden meditating. Early next day, Jesus was up and on his way to the temple. On the brow of Olivet, he paused and wept over the sight his eyes beheld, a spiritually impoverished people, tradition-bound and living under the surveillance of the Roman legions. Early forenoon found him in the temple with his mind made up to take part in the discussions. Meanwhile, Joseph and Mary had also arisen with the early dawn with the intention of retracing their steps to Jerusalem. First, they hastened to the house of their relatives, where they had lodged as a family during the Passover week. But inquiry elicited the fact that no one had seen Jesus. After searching all day and finding no trace of him, they returned to their relatives for the night. At the second conference, Jesus had made bold to ask questions, and in a very amazing way he participated in temple discussions, but always in a manner consistent with his youth. Sometimes his pointed questions were somewhat embarrassing to the learned teachers of the Jewish law. But he evinced such a spirit of candid fairness, coupled with an evident hunger for knowledge, that the majority of the temple teachers were disposed to treat him with every consideration. But when he presumed to question the justice of putting to death a drunken Gentile who had wandered outside the court of the Gentiles, and unwittingly entered the forbidden and reputedly sacred precincts of the temple, one of the more intolerant teachers grew impatient with the lad's implied criticisms, and, glowering down upon him, asked how old he was. Jesus replied, 13 years, lacking a trifle more than 4 months. Then rejoined the now irate teacher, "Why are you here, since you are not of age as a son of the law?" And when Jesus explained that he had received consecration during the Passover, and that he was a finished student of the Nazareth schools, the teachers with one accord derisively replied, "We might have known, he is from Nazareth." But the leader insisted that Jesus was not to be blamed if the rulers of the synagogue at Nazareth had graduated him, technically, when he was 12 instead of 13. And notwithstanding that several of his detractors got up and left, it was ruled that the lad might continue undisturbed as a pupil of the temple discussions. When this, his second day in the temple, was finished, again he went to Bethany for the night, and again he went out in the garden to meditate and pray. It was apparent that his mind was concerned with the contemplation of weighty problems. 5. The Third Day in the Temple. Jesus' third day with the scribes and teachers in the temple witnessed the gathering of many spectators who, having heard of this youth from Galilee, came to enjoy the experience of seeing a lad confuse the wise men of the law. Simon also came down from Bethany to see what the boy was up to. Throughout this day, Joseph and Mary continued their anxious search for Jesus, even going several times into the temple, but never thinking to scrutinize the several discussion groups, although they once came almost within hearing distance of his fascinating voice. Before the day had ended, the entire attention of the chief discussion group of the temple had become focused upon the questions being asked by Jesus. Among his many questions were, 1. What really exists in the Holy of Holies behind the veil? 2. Why should mothers in Israel be segregated from the male temple worshippers? 3. If God is a father who loves his children, why all this slaughter of animals to gain divine favor? Has the teaching of Moses been misunderstood? 4. Since the temple is dedicated to the worship of the Father in heaven, is it consistent to permit the presence of those who engage in secular barter and trade? 5. Is the expected Messiah to become a temporal prince to sit on the throne of David, or is he to function as the light of life in the establishment of a spiritual kingdom? And all the day through, those who listened marveled at these questions, and none was more astonished than Simon. For more than 4 hours this Nazareth youth plied these Jewish teachers with thought-provoking and heart-searching questions. He made few comments on the remarks of his elders. He conveyed his teaching by the questions he would ask. By the deft and subtle phrasing of a question, he would at one and the same time challenge their teaching and suggest his own. In the manner of his asking a question, there was an appealing combination of sagacity and humor which endeared him even to those who more or less resented his youthfulness. He was always eminently fair and considerate in the asking of these penetrating questions. On this eventful afternoon in the temple, he exhibited that same reluctance to take unfair advantage of an opponent which characterized his entire subsequent public ministry. As a youth, and later on as a man, he seemed to be utterly free from all egoistic desire to win an argument merely to experience logical triumph over his fellows, being interested supremely in just one thing, to proclaim everlasting truth and thus effect a fuller revelation of the eternal God. When the day was over, Simon and Jesus wended their way back to Bethany. For most of the distance, both the man and the boy were silent. Again, Jesus paused on the brow of Olivet, but as he viewed the city and its temple, he did not weep. He only bowed his head in silent devotion. After the evening meal at Bethany, he again declined to join the merry circle, but instead went to the garden, where he lingered long into the night, vainly endeavoring to think out some definite plan of approach to the problem of his life work, and to decide how best he might labor to reveal to his spiritually blinded countrymen a more beautiful concept of the Heavenly Father, and so set them free from their terrible bondage to law, ritual, ceremonial, and musty tradition. But the clear light did not come to the truth-seeking lad. 6. The fourth day in the temple. Jesus was strangely unmindful of his earthly parents. Even at breakfast, when Lazarus's mother remarked that his parents must be about home by that time, Jesus did not seem to comprehend that they would be somewhat worried about his having lingered behind. Again he journeyed to the temple, but he did not pause to meditate at the brow of Olivet. In the course of the morning's discussions, much time was devoted to the law and the prophets, and the teachers were astonished that Jesus was so familiar with the scriptures in Hebrew as well as Greek. But they were amazed not so much by his knowledge of truth as by his youth. At the afternoon conference, they had hardly begun to answer his question relating to the purpose of prayer when the leader invited the lad to come forward and, sitting beside him, bade him state his own views regarding prayer and worship. The evening before, Jesus' parents had heard about this strange youth who so deftly sparred with the expounders of the law, but it had not occurred to them that this lad was their son. They had about decided to journey out to the home of Zacharias, as they thought Jesus might have gone thither to see Elizabeth and John. Thinking Zacharias might perhaps be at the temple, they stopped there on their way to the city of Judah. As they strolled through the courts of the temple, imagine their surprise and amazement when they recognized the voice of the missing lad and beheld him seated among the temple teachers. Joseph was speechless, but Mary gave vent to her long pent-up fear and anxiety when, rushing up to the lad, now standing to greet his astonished parents, she said, "My child, why have you treated us like this? It is now more than 3 days that your father and I have searched for your sorrowing. Whatever possessed you to desert us?" It was a tense moment. All eyes were turned on Jesus to hear what he would say. His father looked reprovingly at him, but said nothing. It should be remembered that Jesus was supposed to be a young man. He had finished the regular schooling of a child, had been recognized as a son of the law, and had received consecration as a citizen of Israel. And yet his mother more than mildly upbraided him before all the people assembled, right in the midst of the most serious and sublime effort of his young life, thus bringing to an inglorious termination one of the greatest opportunities ever to be granted him to function as a teacher of truth, a preacher of righteousness, a revealer of the loving character of his Father in heaven. But the lad was equal to the occasion. When you take into fair consideration all the factors which combine to make up this situation, you will be better prepared to fathom the wisdom of the boy's reply to his mother's unintended rebuke. After a moment's thought, Jesus answered his mother, saying, "Why is it that you have so long sought me? Would you not expect to find me in my father's house, since the time has come when I should be about my father's business?" Everyone was astonished at the lad's manner of speaking. Silently, they all withdrew and left him standing alone with his parents. Presently, the young man relieved the embarrassment of all three when he quietly said, "Come, my parents, None has done aught but that which he thought best. Our Father in heaven has ordained these things. Let us depart for home. In silence they started out, arriving at Jericho for the night. Only once did they pause, and that on the brow of Olivet, when the lad raised his staff aloft, and quivering from head to foot under the surging of intense emotion, said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, and the people thereof, what slaves you are, subservient to the Roman yoke, and victims of your own traditions! But I will return to cleanse yonder temple, and deliver my people from this bondage. On the 3 days' journey to Nazareth, Jesus said little, neither did his parents say much in his presence. They were truly at a loss to understand the conduct of their firstborn son, but they did treasure in their hearts his sayings, even though they could not fully comprehend their meanings. Upon reaching home, Jesus made a brief statement to his parents, assuring them of his affection and implying that they need not fear he would again give any occasion for their suffering anxiety because of his conduct. He concluded this momentous statement by saying, While I must do the will of my Father in heaven, I will also be obedient to my Father on earth. I will await my hour. Though Jesus in his mind would many times refuse to consent to the well-intentioned but misguided efforts of his parents to dictate the course of his thinking, or to establish the plan of his work on earth, still, in every manner consistent with his dedication to the doing of his paradise Father's will, he did most gracefully conform to the desires of his earthly father and to the usages of his family in the flesh. Even when he could not consent, he would do everything possible to conform. He was an artist in the matter of adjusting his dedication to duty to his obligations of family loyalty and social service. Joseph was puzzled, but Mary, as she reflected on these experiences, gained comfort, eventually viewing his utterance on Olivet as prophetic of the messianic mission of her son as Israel's deliverer. She set to work with renewed energy to mold his thoughts into patriotic and nationalistic channels, and enlisted the efforts of her brother, Jesus' favorite uncle, and in every other way did the mother of Jesus address herself to the task of preparing her firstborn son to assume the leadership of those who would restore the throne of David and forever cast off the Gentile yoke of political bondage. Paper 126, The Two Crucial Years. Of all Jesus' earth life experiences, the 14th and 15th years were the most crucial. These 2 years, after he began to be self-conscious of divinity and destiny, and before he achieved a large measure of communication with his indwelling adjuster, were the most trying of his eventful life on Urantia. It is this period of 2 years which should be called the great test, the real temptation. No human youth, in passing through the early confusions and adjustment problems of adolescence, ever experienced a more crucial testing than that which Jesus passed through during his transition from childhood to young manhood. This important period in Jesus' youthful development began with the conclusion of the Jerusalem visit and with his return to Nazareth. At first, Mary was happy in the thought that she had her boy back home once more, that Jesus had returned home to be a dutiful son, not that he was ever anything else, and that he would henceforth be more responsive to her plans for his future life. But she was not for long to bask in this sunshine of maternal delusion and unrecognized family pride. Very soon she was to be more completely disillusioned. More and more the boy was in the company of his father. Less and less did he come to her with his problems, while increasingly both his parents failed to comprehend his frequent alternation between the affairs of this world and the contemplation of his relation to his father's business. Frankly, they did not understand him, but they did truly love him. As he grew older, Jesus' pity and love for the Jewish people deepened, but with the passing years there developed in his mind a growing righteous resentment of the presence in the Father's temple of the politically appointed priests. Jesus had great respect for the sincere Pharisees and the honest scribes, but he held the hypocritical Pharisees and the dishonest theologians in great contempt. He looked with disdain upon all those religious leaders who were not sincere. When he scrutinized the leadership of Israel, he was sometimes tempted to look with favor on the possibility of his becoming the Messiah of Jewish expectation, but he never yielded to such a temptation. The story of his exploits among the wise men of the temple in Jerusalem was gratifying to all Nazareth, especially to his former teachers in the synagogue school. For a time, his praise was on everybody's lips. All the village recounted his childhood wisdom and praiseworthy conduct, and predicted that he was destined to become a great leader in Israel. At last, a really great teacher was to come out of Nazareth in Galilee. And they all looked forward to the time when he would be 15 years of age, so that he might be permitted regularly to read the scriptures in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. 2. The death of Joseph. All did go well until that fateful day of Tuesday, September 25, when a runner from Sepphoris brought to this Nazareth home the tragic news that Joseph had been severely injured by the falling of a derrick while at work on the governor's residence. The messenger from Sepphoris had stopped at the shop on the way to Joseph's home, informing Jesus of his father's accident, and they went together to the house to break the sad news to Mary. Jesus desired to go immediately to his father, but Mary would hear to nothing but that she must hasten to her husband's side. She directed that James, then 10 years of age, should accompany her to Sepphoris, while Jesus remained home with the younger children until she should return, as she did not know how seriously Joseph had been injured. But Joseph died of his injuries before Mary arrived. They brought him to Nazareth, and on the following day he was laid to rest with his fathers. Just at the time when prospects were good and the future looked bright, an apparently cruel hand struck down the head of this Nazareth household. The affairs of this home were disrupted, and every plan for Jesus and his future education was demolished. This carpenter lad, now just past 14 years of age, awakened to the realization that he had not only to fulfill the commission of his heavenly Father to reveal the divine nature on earth and in the flesh, but that his young human nature must also shoulder the responsibility of caring for his widowed mother and 7 brothers and sisters, and another yet to be born. This lad of Nazareth now became the sole support and comfort of this so suddenly bereaved family. Thus were permitted those occurrences of the natural order of events on Urantia, which would force this young man of destiny so early to assume these heavy but highly educational and disciplinary responsibilities attendant upon becoming the head of a human family, of becoming father to his own brothers and sisters, of supporting and protecting his mother, of functioning as guardian of his father's home, the only home he was to know while on this world. Jesus cheerfully accepted the responsibilities so suddenly thrust upon him, and he carried them faithfully to the end. At least one great problem and anticipated difficulty in his life had been tragically solved. He would not now be expected to go to Jerusalem to study under the rabbis. It remained always true that Jesus sat at no man's feet. He was ever willing to learn from even the humblest of little children, but he never derived authority to teach truth from human sources. Still, he knew nothing of the Gabriel visit to his mother before his birth. He only learned of this from John on the day of his baptism, at the beginning of his public ministry. As the years passed, this young carpenter of Nazareth increasingly measured every institution of society and every usage of religion by the unvarying test. What does it do for the human soul? Does it bring God to man? Does it bring man to God? While this youth did not wholly neglect the recreational and social aspects of life, more and more he devoted his time and energies to just 2 purposes, the care of his family and the preparation to do his Father's heavenly will on earth. This year it became the custom for the neighbors to drop in during the winter evenings to hear Jesus play upon the harp, to listen to his stories, for the lad was a master storyteller, and to hear him read from the Greek scriptures. The economic affairs of the family continued to run smoothly, as there was quite a sum of money on hand at the time of Joseph's death. Jesus early demonstrated the possession of keen business judgment and financial sagacity. He was liberal, but frugal. He was saving, but generous. He proved to be a wise and efficient administrator of his father's estate. But in spite of all that Jesus and the Nazareth neighbors could do to bring cheer into the home, Mary and even the children were overcast with sadness. Joseph was gone. Joseph was an unusual husband and father, and they all missed him, and it seemed all the more tragic to think that he died ere they could speak to him or hear his farewell blessing.
Please join us next week as we continue the investigation into the young Jesus as he grew from an adolescent into a young man and into one of the greatest teachers that ever walked our planet. We would like to thank the BBC Story of Jesus, the Story of Jesus for Kids, and the Biblical Heritage Foundation for the Story of Jesus, the Urantia Book Fellowship, and the Cosmic Citizen. Please join us next week, share this with your friends, and have them come and listen. They too will enjoy this. See you next week. Gumshoe out.